one of the striking things about Anahuasca is that it encapsulates in a small space some of the tremendous juxtaposed inequality that we see in many 21st century cities these days. So if you came into the Mumbai International Airport and turned down a road, you would see a Hyatt Hotel, you would see an Intercontinental, you'd see the immense wealth of the new Mumbai. But in between all these luxury buildings are communities like Anahuasca, and it's a small slum where the huts are made of all manner of things from brick to tin roofed. And at the time that I first came there, it was all essentially beachfront property because it sat on this vast lake of sewage and petrochemicals. And in this community, people were determined that they could get to the middle class. They could, you know, cross the boundaries between the slum world and the rich one. And they were working very hard in ingenious ways to try to pull that off.
In an interview you did last year with Dave Davies of NPR's Fresh Air, you mentioned the term immersion journalism. I wondered, is that how you describe what you were doing in Mumbai? What was that process like for you? Maybe some of the challenges and limitations.
One of the things that I try to do is to settle into a community for a long period of time and watch how people think and decide and change their lives. It's a different process than what a lot of journalism is coming in after the event and saying, hey, how did you feel, or tell me what happened. But when I'm in a community for a long period of time, I'm actually watching people's lives as they evolve, and sometimes in very dramatic ways. I think that many events in my book were quite dramatic, including wrongful imprisonments and a murder that was classified as a TB death and all these other incidents that you know, when I started, I had no idea would be part of what I was documenting. And what I'm trying to do is engage the reader in the journey as much as I've been personally engaged in it. And, you know, in that way, hoping that the reader can get a little closer to the people whose lives are in the balance than they would otherwise get.
And you call these people of Anahuasca under-citizens. And I wondered, where did you live while you were there in Mumbai? Were you in the neighborhood? Did you have to drive in each day? Or did you really try to become a neighbor to these people?
I lived in different places over the course of the book as a way to get familiar with different aspects of the city. Mainly, I lived near the jail. And I was following a young man, a really incredible young man, who was making a living buying and selling the garbage that richer people threw away. And he'd managed to lift his family of 11 above subsistence. They really were some of the best off people in the slum. And all of a sudden, he and his whole family were falsely accused of a crime, and they ended up in the various jails in the community where I lived. So it just happened that where I lived happened to be a place where the story suddenly reoriented itself.
Abdul, who we follow throughout this book, and I was curious as to why you opted for a third-person narrator, and you really get inside the head of Abdul and so many other of these characters and really get a deep look inside of them. But I wonder what kind of research you had to do to be able to have that sort of authority as a narrator in speaking for them.
It took me... I reported on this book for more than 3 years. I couldn't possibly have told the reader what Abdul was thinking if I'd only spent a few months. It took that level of time to get that nuanced understanding of his life. And you have to remember, Peter, that many of the people in this book, I'm really probably safe to say all, had never before talked about their lives in this kind of detail. They were just working too hard to be introspective in the ways in which people, particularly in this country, are. I try to tell young people who read this book in America that introspection and self-involvement is a luxury. it's a luxury item like anything else. And the people in Anahuasca didn't have that. But one thing that also helped me, and you might not be able to see this as much in the book, but I did an enormous amount of document and investigative research using Freedom of Information Act requests. So that when you're reading a scene in the beginning about Abdul hiding from the police under some garbage, and that scene is not just based on many, many interviews, it's based on records from the police department, records from the courts, records from other places. When I'm describing Anahuasca, I'm also using election records, public health records, that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily call attention to that in the book, but it's part of what gives, I think, the writing an authority and a clarity that there is underlying the sentences a lot of documentation.
As the Springfield campus of the University of Illinois prepares to discuss her book, we're speaking with the author of Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. Catherine Boo, I wanted to briefly go to a clip from your audiobook to perhaps shed some light on the character of Asha. Let's listen in.
Asha had developed her sharp tongue as a child, working the fields of an impoverished village in northeastern Maharashtra. Pointed expression had been a useful defense when laboring among lecherous men. Discretion and subtlety, qualities useful in controlling a slum, were things she had learned since coming to the city. She had by now seen past the obvious truth that Mumbai was a hive of hope and ambition to a profitable corollary. Mumbai was a place of festering grievance and ambient envy. Was there a soul in this enriching, unequal city who didn't blame his dissatisfaction on someone else? Wealthy citizens accused the slum dwellers of making the city filthy and unlivable, even as an oversupply of human capital kept the wages of their maids and chauffeurs low. Slum dwellers complained about the obstacles the rich and powerful erected to prevent them from sharing a new profit. Everyone, everywhere, complained about their neighbors. But in the 21st century city, fewer people joined up to take their disputes to the streets. As group identities based on caste, ethnicity, and religion gradually attenuated, anger and hope were being privatized like so much else in Mumbai. This development increased the demand for canny mediators, human shock absorbers for the colliding, narrowly construed interests of one of the world's largest cities.
That image of the human shock absorber really struck me as a reader and really helped me frame and understand the character of Asha, who tries to climb this social ladder by using politics and corruption and things. And I just wanted to ask you about that passage and where it was derived from. I really feel like your voice as a reporter comes out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you've chosen is at the heart of the book. And even more, it's about Asha is a woman who is 40. She herself is, you know, this moved from poverty and, you know, and is closing in on the middle class. And she has a beautiful daughter who's poised to become the first female college graduate in the slum. You know, one of the questions that I'm asking in this book is, what does it mean to be good and moral in a society where the people who make the rules are not good and moral? And Asha asks one day, you know, she says it's corruption, it's all corruption, but she says, why is it my corruption if the big people say that it's right? And I think that's, you know, that's at the heart of, I mean, one of the things that, Peter, I think we find in unequal cities in the West and in the East is that people see all around them the possibilities of new wealth. And if the normal means of getting ahead break down, people are going to take the illicit means. They see what's possible, and the temptation is just too great. And so what's interesting to me in places like Anawadi is not that some people choose the, quote, wrong path. It's that so many people actually do try to be good. That's the inspiring thing. And some people actually are good.
One of the things that struck me also is you follow this young man who is making his living by recycling the things that rich people throw away and dump near, you know, basically just outside of his house. Other people scavenge it, bring it to him. You were there in India during the start of the global financial crisis, and that had such a ripple effect around the world that it actually impacted the prices of the materials that he was trying to recycle. I thought it was fascinating that it got to that level. And I guess I just wondered, as you look at India's economy today, which appears to be just as bleak, economic growth at a 10-year low, you know, what do you think about as an author who spent so much time there and seeing India today?
I've just come back. I was just in Mumbai with other people in the book, and they are definitely feeling this decline in growth. At the same time, over these years, since economic liberalization, really, people have gotten used to it. They're getting ahead. They're falling backward. They're moving ahead. They're falling backward. And that exhausting pace of life has become the new normal for them. I want the reader to feel that volatility in life and to think about, what does it do to families and communities when there's so little stable ground? And that, I think, is, you know, I'm trying to draw out always the connections between what we see in a slum like Anawadi and what we might see in our own lives, which is that I think for more and more people, permanent work, steady incomes are harder and harder to come by, and more people, you know, can find their lives turned upside down in a second. the tolls that it takes on families and communities, I think hasn't been fully reckoned.
What took you back to Mumbai? Is this a regular thing? Are you checking in on them?
I tried to, after the book came out, and I would go to universities and I would speak and I'd get a fee. And so I'd say, okay, let me put some of this money back into the community and fund educations and healthcare and other projects. And not just for the families in the book, but for many, many, many other families. And we're doing it, and it is absolutely a work in progress. I don't want to make any claims about it, but I go and I see what's going on and see how we can do it better, and I'm learning all the time.
I've caught you then in a unique opportunity to perhaps shed some light on where these characters are today. Can you tell us about Abdul, about Manju, about Sunil? Where are they?
So Abdul is, his dream was to leave Anawadi and work outside the city, and he's achieved that now. But his greatest joy is that he is married and he's had a son, and he loves his son so much, and his deepest wish for his son, that his son never have to sort garbage and recycling. And I think that dream will come true. And Manju is married, and rather newly married, and I hope it's going to be good, but it's too soon to tell. And Sunil is working as an iron worker, and he makes springs for bakery bread makers. He's doing well. He's had a hard life. And one of the things that I try to emphasize in this book but I've seen over and over again, is that if you've had a life that is so disadvantaged early on, the transformations are never going to be smooth. Every success is fragile. And so at this moment, I will tell you that Sunil is doing well, but I don't make predictions for next month. I only hope. I hope that when you read a book like this, that you're not seeing the people in Anawadi as some remote other, but that you're recognizing that there's so much that people have in common with someone like Abdul and Manju. And you might not see it at first, but if you really get to know them, there's a great deal of human connective tissue in this world if we only open ourselves up to it. And I think that once you realize that, then when you see people facing injustice in other places that maybe you're not, you know, that you recognize it not as a distant phenomenon, but something that implicates us all.